listening to the Revolving Door Radio Program on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network.
All right, welcome to this week's Revolving Door with your boy Johnny from the Iron Show. This week, the Revolving Door is made of iron. All right, hey, just wanted to say before we get going here that if after hearing this you would like to hear more of the Iron Show, you can find original studio sessions going way back into ancient history at ironshow.com. In the last few years, we've done live sessions on Thursday nights right after L.A. Marzulli, 7 p.m. West Coast on the Fringe Radio Network archives, found at fringeradionetwork.com/category/iron. First, I would like to give a shout out to my fellow hosts on the Revolving Door Radio program, Natalina, fair Natalina, of extraordinary intelligence, such a wonderful person, a dear, dear friend of mine, and every show that she does on extraordinary intelligence is just a trip through a very highly polished and entertaining and informative and deep, rejuvenating listen to bathe your ears in. Also, we have the Bruce Collins Show, of course, Bruce Collins and Chad Miles as part of the Revolving Door Radio lineup. And then we also have Gons and Basil of Canary Cry Radio. Oh yeah, Canary Cry Radio. The bird, the bird, the bird. CanaryCryRadio.com. I mean, what can I say about Gons and Basil? What can I say about Canary Cry Radio that everybody else has not already said? So go to CanaryCryRadio.com and check them out. Telling you what, man. So anyway, we did a session on Iron Show Live with Rabbi Mike and Matthew Miller. It was a special session, not for Iron Show Live, but rather for the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network. And we did a session about 9/11. So I'm going to present part one of our epic session with Matthew Miller and Rabbi Mike and author William Ramsey, entitled Iron 11.
Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance
of his friend.
Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend.
You're listening to The Iron Show with Johnny McMahon. Oh, yeah! Oh, man, I gotta get those buttons down right. You would expect me to have my buttons in a row by now. Oh dear. Alright. We're just getting going here. We wanted to welcome everyone to of 9/11 September, 9/11/2015. Tonight we are here with our dear friend, Rabbi Mike. Oh, Rabbi Mike, when you are wheeled into surgery to have your gallbladder removed, wake up, you feel so nice, then you discover that they have mistakenly removed your left arm. Does it make you cry?
Why? The lawsuit can help, but that's going to be fantastic.
And you can still pick your nose.
Son, who will happily pick it for me, whether I want him to or not.
Oh, yeah. Dude, you're making me hungry. Stop that.
Dude, I've had so many things leaking out. So much leaking out of my nose the last 3 days.
Are Michael Buggers kosher? I did. I said that. Oh, no. Shows me. That reveals my state of mind this evening. That's not good. Oh, yeah. No, it is good. This is Iron. So we're here for Iron 11. I know Matthew Miller wanted to do this. Let's try to get the boys back in here. Let's see here. Okay. Let's see if we can. Oh, I think. Dear, it looks like our dear friend, Matthew Miller.
What's up?
Oh, yeah!
What's up?
Would you like to try that again? I missed your button.
You missed my button? Oh, my goodness, now I have a button. What's up?
Oh, yeah! Oh, yeah!
Welcome. Iron 11. We see if we can get. Did you know that we have a very special guest tonight? And his name is our dear friend, of course, William Ramsey, whom I call Bill. Bill Ramsey, William Ramsey, author of Occult 9/11 and the New World Order. I think he had a self. Described title here. Let's see if we can bring him on. And we're ringing him. We're ringing him.
Right.
Oh, William.
What's up? Oh, yeah.
I'm here. You hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Oops, I'm sorry. That was the wrong music for the wrong voice.
Oh. Oh, yeah! Wait a minute.
Oh, William, it is so nice to be here with you.
I'm glad to be here as well.
All right!
What about the only one you ever try to make cry, Johnny?
You missed out. I asked Rabbi Mike when he wakes up from surgery and they have mistakenly removed his arm.
Does it make you cry?
We kind of went on to, well, he said that he would not cry because he would imagine the lawsuits that would entail, would ensue. Yeah, that's kind of cool. And the lawsuits that would ensue. That was clever. That was an accident. Just think if I would have written that one, actually. But I didn't. That was an accident. Oh, well. Can't take credit. But and then we went on to discuss about how he could still pick his nose if they removed his left arm. So, and that was... And then I guess we're not even going to go... Well, we won't even go more than that because we're ashamed of what we said next. Anyway,
William, do you know Rabbi Michael Bug?
I do. I see him here on Skype, so I'm familiar with him.
All right.
Did you know that Johnny is now into the Holy Name movement, and his name is now Rabboni Yabuga?
Oh no!
Oh yeah!
How did you choose your name, Rabbi Yabuga? I didn't do. It's apparently changed for me. And next I'm going to find out that I'm in fact Baba Yabuga, and I walk around and go around in a on giant chicken legs, and anyone who gets that is a true mythology nerd.
Cool. Reconnecting with the call. Matthew Miller, how was your day today?
It was good. I worked hard. I got trusses set, so it was a good day.
Yep, I got my butt kicked in the Evil Dust Factory, and I'm sure our guest William Ramsey sold some real estate, didn't you?
I did. I sold a lot of paper.
Did you?
Exactly. That's what I sell, just paper. Not actual real estate, but services. Real estate services.
Oh, like contracts, like of real estate services, like you mean like maintenance contracts and things?
Kind of. Like basically if you're in foreclosure or you want to get out of foreclosure or if your mortgage is lousy, if you want to complain, we help you though.
Really, you're almost like an advocate, sort of middleman type guy?
Yes, exactly. Legal advocate.
Really? And I imagine that you were really busy there for a while, a few years ago, weren't you?
Crazy busy.
And I imagine you will be busy again before much longer.
The good news is people buy and sell property all the time. People are still selling and buying when it goes down and selling and buying when it goes up.
Right, yeah. There's a lot more selling when it goes down or a lot more buying. I know that the people that have money are buying up everything at discounts.
Typically, the rich people get to pool all their money in big old funds and they pick up these distressed properties at 30% of what their market value is. It's close to being criminal.
It is when you figure that the whole thing is operates by design, at least partially by design. I mean, and that's kind of the subject of our show tonight. We're talking about 9/11 on this eve of 9/11. We're talking about 9/11/2001 on this eve of 9/11/2015, and so. We have with us Matthew Miller, of course, the Tough Man Guru. We have, who is a prophecy expert, of course. We have, Rabbi Mike, who has slipped off the call here, but we're trying to get him back. And we have author William Ramsey, author of Occult 9/11 and the New World Order. And, it's an honor to be here. So, I guess, you know what? I'd like to ask some questions right off the bat. William Ramsey, what were you doing when 9/11 happened? Where were you, and what was your reaction, and kind of what went down that day?
I remember I was at home, and I was watching. So I got home and turned on the TV, like not exactly at 9 o'clock, but maybe at 11 or noon or something, and just sat there and watched the TV for the rest of the day. And I fully believe that terrorists attacked the United States. I was angry. I was pretty much locked in 100%. And it was a shocking event. And I just remember when the towers fell, I literally could not believe it, that they weren't there. Like, it just did not compute. It didn't make sense. And it took me probably a good hour to go, wow, they really are gone, I thought that people were misstating something, or there was an error in the transmission or something. But, it was pretty amazing. And I was probably in shock in a daze for, at least a couple days. I remember just being kind of, some kind of PTSD or something like that. And, it wasn't until it took me a couple of years really to see through, some of the deception that was involved in 9/11. And that's what led me to research everything. And it kind of led me to Crowley and the occult and the book. It was my first book. So it still is a day I remember, and it's an important event, I think, in world history. And I think I'm still reading about people who are still learning new facets and new elements of that event. It was a very complex environment leading up to 9/11 and the event and heading after that. So even 14 years after, it's still pretty amazing event.
It is, and we keep getting new, you know, we keep getting new information, and there's new research being done. And Matthew Miller, could you give us your own personal account of the events of 9/11? What were you doing, and how did you handle it, and how did you process it? Where were you at the time, and who was the first person that you called or went to go see or whatever?
Well, I was in the middle of building a house. The house was 9,000 square feet, and me and my buddy had went to the plumbing supply store, Lee Supply, and we walked into the room, supply house, and you know, we stood there for a few minutes, like, "Hey, man, you know, we need some parts right now. We're getting ready to hook the gas up," and they were in a daze, and I mean in a haze. Everyone from the back was out. Everyone, even the salesmen, were out on the front floor watching the big screen TV. And, you know, it took me a minute to even really figure out what was going on. I get kind of irritated. And they knew me so well that I was of want, if they're really busy, I would just walk back in the back myself and get my own parts. You know, they knew me very well, so it was no big deal for me to just walk back there and get my own parts. So I get kind of frustrated because I said something three times, especially to Jason, one of my good buddies there. There were two gentlemen that worked there that was named Jason. And I thought it was kind of odd because they just looked at me and looked back at the TV. And I'm like, "Look, man, the gas company's going to be there in like a half hour, man. We need these parts." And I just looked at my buddy, and he was staring at the TV. So I look at the TV for a second. I don't care what's on the stupid boob tube. So I walk right behind the counter, go back into the back. I remember very clearly I had to get two gas valves, three-quarter, and one gas valve that was 1 inch, because this house was so big, it had 6 fireplaces and 4 furnaces in it. It took 1 million BTUs to heat this house. So I come back out, you know, and I'm getting kind of irritated. I'm like, "Look, guys, somebody needs to ring this up." And I'm like, at that time, it kind of hit me. These guys are in a daze. They are in a daze. They're hypnotized looking at this TV. So I looked up there. I said, "Man, hey, what's going on?" And he just looked at me and looked back at the TV. So I grabbed Jace by the arm. "Hey, man, what is the deal?" And I look at the TV. Yeah, I see the smoking from the first tower. He says, "We've been attacked." "We've been attacked?" "Yeah." I said, "Well, what, man? An intercontinental ballistic missile or what?" He said, "No, an airplane attacked us." I'm like, "Okay, well, did it, you know, drop bombs?" And he just stopped listening to my question. So I, you know, look up at the TV and finally started reading the little ticker at the bottom. And I read it, and I'm like, "Why are you people acting like we're under a military attack?" "No, we're not." So anyway, I'm sitting there watching it, holding my box, you know, of parts. And I see the second plane hit the second tower. And I look around, and it didn't even faze them. It did not faze them. I said, "Hey, man, another airplane just hit the other tower. Hey, did anybody see the second plane at the tower?" And then finally my buddy, he's like, "Oh, my gosh, it did. They hit the other tower." And I'm like, "Well, it wasn't a missile. That was, you know, a plane. So it's not a military attack." And I just keep looking around, man. So finally, you know, I hit. I said, "Hey, Dan, we got to go now. We got to get back to job site. The gas company scheduled to be there." So we hop in the truck and take off, and by the time we get back to the job site, the framers that was working there that day had the radio on. They were all huddled around it, and it was just the strangest thing to me, because it didn't faze me. It didn't affect me at all. And I know that probably bothers a lot of people, but it didn't I mean, it did concern me when, you know, I was told we were attacked. Well, if we were underneath a military attack, this is serious. But when I figured out, no, it was just, you know, some crazy people committing suicide with airplanes. It's not the first time that's happened. I mean, I'm well familiar with the first time the Empire State Building got hit. I studied it. So psychologically, it really didn't affect me at all. And a lot of people take offense to that when I tell them, but, I mean, I'm telling you the truth. It didn't affect me. And when I got home that night, my wife told me all about it and gave me the details. And she was visibly disturbed because of the people committing suicide. That's what bothered my wife. And I said, well, that's one of the things that I wondered about. I didn't see no choppers on those towers. They obviously had not attempted to rescue anybody above the areas of impact. And, you know, she said, yeah. And people were just jumping out, and they just watched them. And that just completely blew me away. What do you mean they just watched them? So that really blew me away. And the more I looked into it, the more the obvious was adequately evident. This was not a naturally occurring event by any stretch of the imagination. There had to have been great forces at work here. And I'm sure that this kind of takes everybody by surprise because we got this new movie out, The San Andreas Fault. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, I've worked with plenty of hazard and rescue people. And they wouldn't have been able to ground any chopper pilots. They would have been in the air on the way. So I know a whole lot, and I'm very familiar with several very good friends of mine work in that field of expertise. And when I asked them about it, they were just as angry and upset as I was. Yeah, they didn't do nothing. They literally left them die. So that's the really point that got me upset on that day, that something's obviously not right because you just don't let people die. And then on top of that, you know, during the evacuation, all of the firefighters that were attempting to rescue, any of the innocent people out of there, it collapsed right on top of them. And then, I don't know, Johnny, I guess it was sometime later that I caught the same stuff that William Ramsey did, especially with the molten steel. I'm well familiar with physics, and I'm well familiar when, steel melts, and there's no way, there's no way that steel melts at the temperature that you could produce a furnace effect with jet fuel. It can't happen. It does not have enough BTUs to do so. It can't do that. So, but when I heard that about the molten steel, and my wife told me about that too. She said that she'd seen that two or three days later when I got home from work. She said, yeah, there was a fireman on there that said, you know, they were cleaning up and there was still molten steel. I said, no, that's impossible. I said, well, let me look. And when I did look, one thing really disturbed me as I looked at the photos, because they wouldn't show you the molten steel, but they wouldn't show you any porcelain either. And people don't realize the effect that even a catastrophic blast has on porcelain. That's why it's used as a shield against laser radiation, directed energy attack. And it bothered me that there was no urinals, there was no bathroom sinks, and I mean not one. And on top of that, me being an electrician and a plumber, let me ask everybody this. Does anybody have even a remote clue of how much wire was in those towers? And I mean let's just take the outlets. Ladies and gentlemen, there should have been massive tangles of just electrical wire and, by all means, pipe. And I mean lots of pipe, people. Lots of pipe. Copper pipes for the supply lines. They also used an inch and a half copper in the waste lines. Now look, I'm being serious with you. Ladies and gentlemen, do you remember any of that stuff being shown, being carted away? No, you don't. So that's my telling. And like I said, I know it upsets a lot of people and offends them that on the day that it happened, it didn't faze me. I didn't go into this daze, but I am well aware of what happened to other people. I witnessed it, and it bothered me that they were mesmerized this way. So that's my story about 9/11, Johnny.
Rabbi Mike, how about you? What were you doing at the time, and what was your immediate response, at least initially, and then I guess, you know, like the same as the same kind of response as Matthew Miller gave, kind of that type of a time frame thing.
Well, I was at the time working for Nextel in their Atlanta call center, which was the biggest and most competent of the three call centers. I was on the escalations team. Basically, if someone, particularly one of our larger clients, wasn't happy about something, it got put to me to try to, do whatever was necessary to make it right and so forth. So I was coordinating with, you know, tech support and everything else. And so I get to work that day sometime not long after 10 o'clock, maybe 11. And honestly, I wasn't in the habit of flipping on the TV or listening to the radio on the way to work. I tended to listen to my own CDs on the way to work, and I tended to, get up in the morning and, you know, read a bit over breakfast or something like that. So I had no idea that anything really was going on until I got there, and I walk in, and everyone in the call center is alternating between furious talking on the phone and staring at the TVs. And I glance up at the TVs, and I'm seeing, you know, I guess by that point in the morning, it would have been the replays. And I see, you know, the World Trade Center, and it's like, oh, a fire broke out or something like that. And then I'm watching as the second plane, you know, hits in the replays. And it's like, what? That's got to be a movie. That's got to be some kind of, you know, there's something playing on TV or whatever. And so I turned to someone and it's like, what's going on? It's like, World Trade Center got hit. I'm like, what do you mean it got hit? It's like, you know, a couple of planes flew into it. And I'm just like, what? And immediately I get flagged down by my manager, who explains, see, at Nextel, for those who didn't know, their big deal at the time was not just that they had cell phones, but their cell phones were also CB radios that could both communicate directly and use the Nextel cellular system for boosting. And so we were very popular among construction workers and emergency response units at the time. And we are doing – we spent the next day doing everything possible just to keep the network from completely crashing. We were getting calls, and I personally handled the calls from New York City Fire and Rescue, and they were, you know, begging us to turn on more phones because they didn't have enough to go around to deal with, you know, to really coordinate the effort. And we had to explain to them, I'm sorry, if we try to add anything right now, we risk crashing the whole system. I mean, we're having to, you know, prioritize calls and block other calls and so forth just to keep you guys active. And so my first day after that happened was so busy, I didn't really have time to reflect or go numb or anything like that. I mean, my response to an emergency or an emotionally hitting event is I sort of go into, it's not numbness, it's just my emotions sort of get shunted to the side while I'm dealing with the immediate problems, and I had plenty of problems to deal with that day. Didn't really get a chance to reflect on it till later. Of course, the whole day dealing with the ramifications of it. I don't know about the helicopters. I know that the police and fire departments in New York were busy as heck, and you know, dealing with the cross traffic and the communications virtual blackout. Because of course, you know, the first thing everyone does, and the cell phone system at the time, of course, was not prepared for the kind of load that it would be today. First thing anyone does in a situation like that, they're calling up everyone they know. They're calling up their loved ones. They're trying to call into New York to find out if their loved ones are okay. The thing that struck me later as I was sort of, I mean, I was there listening to the early reports and actually talking to some of the officers on the scenes, and the early estimates that they had for the number of people that would be dead were in the tens of thousands because of how many people would normally be in the buildings at that particular time of day. Now, how many people did we actually lose in the initial attack? It wasn't tens of thousands.
It was right around 3,500.
Yep. Which was about a sixth of what one person on the scene I talked to was afraid that it was going to be. He was afraid it's going to be like, because those towers hold like, what, 50,000 people at peak, and it was like in the morning when everyone was coming in. And I'm not a structural engineer. Okay, I've watched the arguments on both sides of that. But it struck me, you know, that's really odd. I mean, you know, and at the time I just took it for, you know, God's blessing on it, that we lost that few in that situation. I mean, you know, if the towers had collapsed unevenly, okay, if they'd gone just a little bit sideways, they would have been collapsing into other buildings around them instead of coming straight down. Now, of course, gravity works straight down, but structures that are damaged unevenly don't always go that way. That's the reason why we pay, you know, when we want to remove a building, we pay a lot of experts to spend months studying the building, stripping out absolutely everything they can, and very carefully studying the original diagrams and everything else to set their charges to make sure that it comes straight down.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you know, you can go and look on YouTube. There are plenty of examples where it didn't. Not that they go completely sideways, but we're just, it wasn't as, you know, straight down as it could have been. There was some risk and so forth. So the thing that, it just sort of struck me as odd. And I've never been satisfied with any of the explanations I've gotten on any side. One of the problems I've had with, like, the truther movement is that there's sort of an agreement that there's something that smells wrong. You know, there are certain details of, like, okay, that's not right. Matthew Mueller points out, okay, why aren't we seeing more porcelain? Why aren't we seeing more pipes just sticking out at weird angles or whatever? Honestly, I hadn't thought about that particular aspect before now. It'd be interesting to go back and review the footage. But everyone just sort of agrees there's something that doesn't feel right about the whole thing. But the theories that come out of that, there's no real consensus on what did happen, which bugs me. And then some of the theories, it's like, okay, that's the sort of thing I would introduce if I were trying to introduce a false flag operation. I mean, you know, when people are talking about, yes, it was obviously a laser beam from space that brought down the towers, they're like, why? All you need is a few, you know, you need some demolitions set at the right place that you could smuggle in at night if you wanted to, if that was your goal, was to bring down the tower straight down. Frankly, you know, it's not that hard to find a few dozen disgruntled Muslims to use as your front operation at the very least. I mean, you know, when people are talking about, oh, yes, there was obviously a missile or something like that, it's like, why bother? There are so many easier ways to do it. If you're going to create a conspiracy, you've got to go for the maximum impact with the minimum risk, which means you have to have something that requires a minimal number of people that actually know what the heck is going on. And it's so much, I mean, frankly, there is no shortage of people out there that hate us. It'd be much easier to make use of an existing plot or even, you know, engineer the plot, you know, be the person that's supplying the money or something like that, than it would be to just completely fake the thing from the ground up. And yet you hear, I have all these theories that end up way out there. I remember something Dr. Heiser said about, you know, talking about the whole Roswell incident, that some of the explanations they came up with were so wacky, it was like they wanted the alien mythos to be continued. And that's sort of where I wonder occasionally on some of the 9/11 front. I mean, you put in some false information enough to make the whole thing look wacky on a late night talk show, and then you can make it, you know, sort of disappear from the consciousness as wacky. I have enjoyed William Ramsey's connections. I think he's done some great work there. I don't know that I would call anything conclusive in terms of an answer, but the connections he's pulled out, yes, absolutely. I think that that indeed certain individuals and a certain immortal individual in particular have deliberately put marks all over this thing. By the same token, okay, one of the best books on the subject I've read is Rabbi Jonathan Kahn's The Harbinger, where he points out this thing happened right on top of what was arguably the place of the birthplace of the nation, not the signing of the Declaration of Independence, but the inauguration of George Washington as the first president, in a time when all of America was praying together for the success of the country. The church where that took place is right at the foot of the towers. That's not coincidental. That's part of a larger pattern. And it's one of those things that my own studies have not gone in that direction, so I don't know that I have a whole bunch of cool facts and figures and everything else to contribute to tonight, but I will say there is a larger pattern when it comes to 9/11. And one piece of that larger pattern I will throw out that I'm aware of is that 2003 years before 9/11, going by the solar calendar, was a Rosh Hashanah. And on that Rosh Hashanah, in 3 BC, the sun was rising in Virgo. Jupiter, Mercury, and Venus were in Leo over Virgo's head, making 12 stars crowning Virgo with the 9 stars of Leo. And the new moon that marks the beginning of all Jewish months was at her feet. And Dr. Heiser has argued that sign is described in Revelation because John is describing to us what the sky looked like at the time of Yeshua's birth. For various reasons, I think it's possible he was born 14 days later at the beginning of Sukkot. But wouldn't it be interesting if, and indeed there's a good case to be made, that he was born on September 11th, 3 BCE, 2003 years before 9/11. And I don't know if that points to anything conclusive, but the fact that on the solar Roman calendar, our Lord was born possibly on September 11th, that to me is one of the big glaring, flashing lights on the whole thing. That there is it's not just a random terrorist attack. There is something, part of a deeper pattern, and part of a spiritual pattern, not just one being moved by mortal men on this plane, but one that's being moved by powers and principalities. At the very least, no matter who you think did it, you can't deny the changes that have taken place because of it. The loss of freedom around the world, suspension of constitutional rights, CIA interrogation camps, which aren't really new, but the scope of them is new. The employment of mercenaries, the destabilization of the Middle East, because we, whether intentionally or not, botched Iraq. All these things are all, no matter who you'd blame 9/11 on, all these things started there. And that's not insignificant.
Yes, definitely. I was, at the time, I was working in the Evil Dust Factory, and somebody came in, one of the guys came yelling into the shipping department where I was working, loading trucks with my forklift, that America was under attack, and we all ran up to the upstairs lunchroom, and I watched it on TV, and right away I said, it's not real. And everybody's like, what do you mean it's not real? It's not real, a real attack. And then, what do you mean it's not a real attack? And I didn't know what to say. I said, it's not real, it's fake. Nobody's attacking us. It's just, we need to go to war. They're starting a war. And everybody thought I was insane, and I just kept my mouth shut after that. Because I made people really angry when I said that. And I made people angry today when I said that. I said, I have a post here. Somebody asked me, it was Doug Overmyer on the social media, asked, what were you doing? Who did you talk to when this happened? Or what was your reaction? And I wrote, I remember being disappointed that it was not a real enemy. I knew the whole thing was fake right from the beginning. So And then so I know one person got mad, pretty mad. The people who jumped were not fake. The firemen and police officers who died were not fake. There was nothing fake about that day. Fake is to imply it never happened. Well, it did happen. I mean, obviously it happened. I never did believe it was a real attack. I thought the whole thing was staged to get us into war. I remember my dad talking in the months before that. It was a wild time for me because my mom was dying in the hospital. She had brain cancer. She had 7 golf ball sized tumors in her brain and she had them in her liver. Now they were all over. And so it was a tough time for me. And I remember sitting in the hospital with my mom and a couple days later and she's going, "So what do you think about all this?" I said, it's not real. She goes, "It's not real?" I said, "No." She goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "I think we're going to war." She was really quiet for a long time, just staring at this TV, and then she just looked at me and she goes, "I think so too." And then she fell asleep. And so at least mom, I think mom was on my page. She was in pretty bad shape by then, but I just didn't believe it at all. And I was probably one of the few. And then what really closed it for me was, you know, I know that a lot of people are going to probably hate me for this, but as a fringe Christian, I am definitely a far left wing Democrat. You know, I am not what you would think of as like your typical conservative Republican Christian guy. I'm a left wing Democrat socialist. And I hated the Republican Party. I hated Bush. Bush was the one that made people pee in a cup. And his son got up there, George Bush Jr., and said, the one thing he said, and I knew it sealed it for me, he said, "Freedom has been dealt a serious blow." He didn't say America has been dealt a serious blow, or, you know, the United States, or, you know, this country. He said, "Today freedom has been dealt a serious blow." And I knew right then that this was their move. This is a big move for them to come down even harder on us, to invade into our freedoms and our private lives. Because they'd done it already. I'd seen it happen the year my daughter was born in 1989, when they forced millions of Americans to submit to medical tests and under federal law. And I saw that as the very beginning of the real evil that has overtaken this country. And I saw that 9/11 as an extension of that. So anyway, your reactions to me. It's pretty wild, huh?
I think I'm increasingly cynical about politics since 9/11. I mean, I sort of cut my teeth on politics in the Clinton era, where, you know, I came up on the right-hand side of things, and Clinton was, you know, the big enemy, and, you know, was, but that didn't make the enemy of my enemy my friend necessarily either. And the more I've learned about sort of where the political parties are pulled from, and the more I've learned sort of the history about that, it's more and more it's like, okay, so it's basically, you know, okay, do you want to vote for the communists or the fascists? Take your pick, you know. And I really don't think that the solution is political anymore. And I've become sort of, I wouldn't necessarily say apolitical, but it's I've lost faith in, you know, voting as the thing that's going to solve the problem. I mean, you know, even if you get in on the primaries, which people should pay a lot more attention to them than they do, but even in the primaries, the candidates are very much groomed and the process is very controlled on both sides. I'm not sure America's got the stomach for real freedom anymore. If it comes down to it, I don't think America has the moral fortitude for real freedom anymore.
That's okay. William Ramsey.
I just want to follow up on Mike's kind of position that so many things changed on 9/11. You know, we went to war. We basically had war in so many different countries under Bush, the Bush administration, Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a minimization of individual and human rights in the United States and around the world. There was the use of torture and the elimination of habeas corpus, which is incredible, really like 900 years of legal tradition. Massive increases in military spending, cradle-to-grave surveillance state, and just the transformation of the character of all kinds of global institutions towards the one-world government, you know, aim. So I do think that this, I think that just showing the kind of implementation of these kind of political changes was another sign that there was an agenda behind the event that was different than a Muslim vengeance meme or an idea. You know, there's something else going on. Why would the Muslims, you know, want to take away our rights? Like they, George Bush says, like you said, they took away our freedom. Well, why is George Bush doing the opposite of that and curtailing our freedom for 8 years in a variety of different means and ways? So, you know, I've heard people say that the Twin Towers are a symbolic of a doorway, or Boaz and Jachin of the temple in Jerusalem, that not only they symbolically symbolize not only those pillars at the temple, but also the passing through from one stage to another. And I think that history has bore that fact out. I think that that's exactly really what happened on 9/11.
It's kind of like Sid Barrett in the original Pink Floyd. Jimi Hendrix said that Sid Barrett was the axis from the axis point between all the music that had ever been and all the music that ever will be. And kind of that sound, it reminds me of that. It's kind of the towers were kind of the axis.
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, it just changed almost everything. I mean, all political expression, military, cultural things changed. Back then, you know, it was very dangerous and very daring to challenge the 9/11 myth. People, you know, lost jobs, and it was a lot more dangerous than it is today. And I think that that's also indicative that somebody doesn't want, you know, somebody's enforcing a certain viewpoint. And, you know, I think that it's just so much that happened. You know, they pumped and dumped the entire economy. A lot of people don't talk about that. But after 9/11, the economy, and I working in real estate, the economy, you know, had 0% interest rates, and it supercharged. So yeah. People got loans free and easy. And then right at the end of George Bush's administration in 2007, 2008, the whole thing melted down in an epic global meltdown. Really something that the world has never seen probably since, you know, the 40s or the 30s, I should say, or, you know, was it 1929? So, you know, it's just it just really was an incredible era of, for me, just deception and manipulation on really all levels.
Matthew Miller, he is the tough man guru.
What's the proper pronunciation of your rabbinic name, Johnny? Is it Yagusha? Is that right?
No, it's Rabboni Yabuga.
Yabuga. Okay, I got it.
Yes. Yes.
There it is.
I was in the hospital last weekend, and yes, an angel came to me and told me that his name shall now be Rabboni Yabuga.
It's always good to know that, you know, my name was given by, under the influence of really good hospital drums, you know?
Matthew Miller.
Yes.
Were you listening to the Reverend William Ramsey there?
Yes, I was. I agree with everything that he said. We can certainly define the events that happened that day as a game changer. We can certainly define it that way. The rise, well, the rise and the falling, I guess. You have a rise of a militarized praetoric state, just like Rome was, and you also have the fall of freedom. So kind of like a seesaw axis point. It was the rise and it was the fall of many things. And everything, actually, that a freedom-loving people should naturally, by definition, hate. And yet, for some strange, odd reason, they have done nothing about it. And I mean absolutely nothing about it. Mm. You know, it's common knowledge that we have massacred 1 million Iraqi civilians since that day that were never in any military uniform. But it was our military that has killed them. There is under no pretense that any people occupying these shores would have ever permitted that. That's the way I kind of got the feeling, as all three of you were speaking there, that yes, it was an axis point, but like a seesaw, it was most definitely the rise of many things, but the falling of many things too, both of which are detrimentally important for a free, and I mean by free, as in religious freedom, for any nation or state or tribe or language. We all need to kind of take that to the bank, because now, I'm sure that everybody's well aware of, Rabbi Mike's reference there to the destabilization of the Middle East, which has brought about, now this is on record, the greatest refugee crisis since World War II and the Nazis with ISIS. Disturbing. Both not only their thoughts, but their feelings on the matter. And people don't hit the pause button and look at what really happened, because this is where the rubber hits the road. I mean, we've done had several God-fearing sheriffs come out and disclose to the public that they have been told that if you hold to the Bible as your standard, you are an extremist. And ladies and gentlemen, that's my nickname. I had four professors exclusively call me the extremist. There was no black or there was no gray in me. I was either yay or nay. I was never anything in between. But when you look at it that way, ladies and gentlemen, I don't have much to say about it. It's disturbing. I don't know. I can't find the right English word for it. But when you look at the results of what this teeter-totter axis pivot point created, it kind of reminds me of the feeling I get whenever I look at William's book cover. It always has. The first time I did it, when I had him on my broadcast for an interview, that image disturbs me. Once I look at just a few minutes, my emotions eventually culminate in fury. I get very mad looking at that because I know what those eyes right there in the center of the towers, represent that. And he put it perfectly there on that cover, right in the middle of that which fell is that which rose, that pivot point like a seesaw. And Johnny, it disturbs me as much as when I, it wasn't but a month ago, I think, that I had my sons watch the videos of when they were carrying out the Jews, of course, because they had to put them in piles. And of course, it was the German people that was forced to do it, that they were making these citizens do it, because we had massive amount of bodies to deal with, and they were having to collect the dead out of the internment camps. I get that same feeling when I think about this pivot point, this seesaw event in history.
Amen. Amen. I'm trying to think of where to take this. I mean, I thought it's probably, I'd like to eventually get to the future. You know, what we like foresee as like the next attack or the next stage, because, if you ask me, I think that this thing, that was like phase one. And, we're nearing the end of phase one, in my opinion, and phase two is about to ensue. And well, that's scary.
I think you're right. I mean, right now, okay, one of the things that candidly does bother me about certain aspects of the Truth Movement is there is sort of a, the enemy of my enemy is my friend response to Islam. And right now, Islam, in primarily in the form of ISIS, but frankly, ISIS is just the latest and most violent example, is slaughtering Christians by the millions. There's a Christian Holocaust going in the Middle East. Okay. We need to be careful. We occasionally talk in these circles about the Hegelian dialectic, where, you know, the powers that be are trying to, you know, get us to take a side. And, you know, we like to try to plant ourselves above the sides and stay on God's sides and not worry about politics and so forth. And I agree with that. But I think that we have to be careful not to be taken by the side that, you know, tries to claim that, oh, well, you know, Muslims, they follow one God, they're worshiping our God, so they're not the enemy. Let's go after the Luciferians here. Well, I'm sorry. I have been, since finding certain things in Scripture that I had overlooked because of my biases towards everything being about the West, I think that regardless of what you think about the end-time scenario, you've got to factor in Islam one way or the other. And honestly, I think that those who openly hate God here are more than happy to incite Muslims around the world to be sort of the shock troops, to go after Christians, to attack Christians all over the world.
All right, we're going to cut it off right there. That's the end of part one of Iron 11. So when next the Iron Show crew invades the revolving door, we will conclude with part two.
Listening to the Revolving Door Radio Program on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network.